I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. A friend of mine, his name is Joe, was walking across the university campus one day, and all of a sudden he was attacked by a hawk, a Cooper's hawk. The claws of the bird drew some blood from Joe's head, and this whole experience, aside from the fact that it was a bit traumatizing for him, was certainly worth a Facebook post. And that immediately generated all sorts of comments, and you can be confident that in the mix of comments were several allusions to Alfred Hitchcock. Birds can actually be vicious. Apparently, this hawk was not exactly vicious, just protective. It wanted to protect a nearby nest. And Joe, my friend Joe, must have looked like something of a threat. He doesn't look like a threat to me, but the bird certainly thought he was. Have you ever been strafed by a bird? I have. I have seen angry ducks and angry geese. In fact, when I was a young boy, my family kept a goose for a very short while. I say a short while because the animal had it out for my dad in particular. Dad could not step out into the yard without rankling this goose, and Dad's shin bones got the worst of it. We did get rid of the goose. Well, we are going to talk about Hitchcock, actually. The movie The Birds will get some special attention in our conversation. But first, we want to delve into one of Hitchcock's better-known creative collaborations, a very productive collaboration with leading man Cary Grant. Our guest for our conversation is author and filmmaker Tony Lee Morrell. He has written three books on Alfred Hitchcock, I understand. Here's titles for you: Hitchcock and the Making of Marnie, The Making of Hitchcock's The Birds, and Alfred Hitchcock's Movie-Making Masterclass. He's on the line with us from the UK. Tony Lee Morrell, welcome to our program.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Did you have any particular point of entree into Hitchcock that's worth telling us about? I mean, how were you introduced in the very beginning?
I watched I Confess when I was 11 years old, and it made such a huge impression on me. I immediately recognized his skill as a filmmaker. I didn't really know what a MacGuffin was at the time, or really about the psychology, but I was just very caught up with the story and the storytelling and the emotions. And I Confess stars Montgomery Clift and Anne Baxter, and Clift plays a priest who's given a secret in confession and he can't tell. And it's really classic Hitchcock about ambiguity and the kind of emotions that the lead characters go through. So I was really enthralled at a very young age.
I'm going to say that goes back for years now. 11 is kind of young for an introduction to Hitchcock. Last night, I watched The Birds with my 12-year-old, and the rating for us was a PG-13, and I thought, well, he's just on the cusp there. He was a little frightened. And do you think at age 11, you say you were smitten by it? Was it frightening to you? Did it do any damage to you, actually?
Well, I didn't start with Psycho or The Birds, so I Confess is quite tame in comparison. If I'd seen Psycho, I was probably very scared at the age of 11. I think I was just had this respect for Hitchcock as a filmmaker. It was beautifully shot. You know, Clift and Baxter played great leads, and it had classic Hitchcock ingredients like the villain, the wrongfully accused man. I know we're going to go on to talk about Cary Grant, but that's obviously something which Montgomery Clift fulfills, the wrongfully accused man, which is a big central theme and character in Hitchcock's films. So it all came together for me at a young age, and since then I've watched every Hitchcock film and obviously written three books about him.
Well, we are very interested in this creative collaboration, the relationship. I understand it could have been tense at times between Cary Grant and Alfred Hitchcock, and yet they worked together. It didn't get in their way that there was a little bit of tension.
Absolutely, and it's appropriate that you're calling me because I'm in Bristol, and that's where Cary Grant was born. He was born as Archibald Leach in Bristol. You probably know his story. He was born in 1904. And at a young age, he ran away to the circus. And it's really his athleticism and acrobaticness which helped him become a leading man in Hollywood, as well as his suave and debonair looks. And that attracted Hitchcock to him, obviously, because casting Cary Grant as a leading man in Notorious and also Suspicion to begin with in the 1940s,
because he encaptured all the qualities that Hitchcock wanted to be. When you look at Cary Grant, he was very much the antithesis of Hitchcock. He was tall and handsome, very attractive to the ladies. So he made a big impression on Hitchcock, and obviously his charisma. You know, he was a star because he had huge charisma, which really radiated on screen.
Well, if he had charisma, if he was a presence, was there a bit of a prima donna that maybe just a little bit of ego that made the relationship trouble between the director and the actor?
Yes, there was, as Hitchcock kind of groomed Cary Grant, and Cary Grant became a star in his own right. There was a little bit of tension because Hitchcock very much enjoyed presenting the woman's point of view. If you look at Suspicion with Joan Fontaine, and then Ingrid Bergman in Notorious. Hitchcock, in an interview, said that he had some tensions because Cary Grant felt he was being upstaged by the woman's point of view, whether it's Joan Fontaine or Ingrid Bergman. And he made a famous quote to Hitchcock saying, "Oh, you've thrown the picture to the woman again." I think he did that when he saw Notorious because the viewer, the audience, has great sympathies for Ingrid Bergman when she marries Claude Rains in the picture, and then she's actually being poisoned by Rains and his mother. And so Cary Grant, becoming the star that he was, felt that Hitchcock betrayed him slightly by giving the woman's point of view. It's nonsense, of course, because you can't really have a leading man without a leading lady, and they both work superbly together. But that's typical Hollywood insecurity, I'm sure.
When you mentioned the acrobatic or circus background of Cary Grant, that immediately reminds me of the crop duster scene, and there's a little bit of physicality there.
Absolutely, and Hitchcock played to that because if you just watching Cary Grant in North by Northwest, and I'd like to say that is probably the definitive Hitchcock film because it has all the ingredients that we talk about, like the wrongfully accused man. But if you watch Grant, he's just a pleasure to watch him at a two-hour movie, not only boarding the 20th Century Limited train, also the crop duster sequence, but obviously most famously as he scampers across Mount Rushmore in the climax. And so you're really watching Cary Grant go from A to B in that movie, and he's dressed immaculately in that Kilgour suit. And Hitchcock very much wanted to present a man right at the beginning, Madison Avenue type executive, impeccably dressed in this Savile Row suit. And I spoke to the designers of that suit, Kilgour, who are very famous Savile Row tailors, and they say it was a Prince of Wales checked wool, and just shows this kind of finery and detail. And Hitchcock was very keen to put Cary Grant through the mill. So in the crop duster sequence, he runs like a jackrabbit through the prairie, and he gets that suit dirty, and there's that amusing sequence when he meets up with Eva Mary Saint in the Chicago Hotel, and he has to dust off his suit and get changed. But it was all very carefully choreographed by Hitchcock, which is, why North by Northwest, I think, is a definitive movie.
I might go down a rabbit hole here, but this this juxtaposition of the fine clothing and then the improbable scene where you get a little dirty, it just reminds me of a scene I saw last night in The Birds, where here somebody's wearing furs and a lovely dress, then of course the blood comes, right? Is that a standard trick of Hitchcock's to dress somebody up for the problem?
Absolutely. If you talk to costume designers and film theorists, they will quote Cary Grant's suit and Tippi Hedren's green suit in The Birds as two iconic film suits which really go through the mill. And I spoke to Tippi Hedren about the green suit, and she said the color green was deliberately chosen because it was easy on the eye, because the structure of The Birds, it's told over a long weekend. So if you have to watch Melanie Daniels for 4 days in the same suit, you want something easy on the eye. You know, doctors wear cool green because it's easy for the patients to look at. And as you say, she starts in her finery, and she slowly, throughout the movie, becomes disheveled. And a central theme of Hitchcock was complacency. He saw characters like Tippi Hedren's Melanie Daniels and Cary Grant's Roger Thornhill as characters who were very entrapped in complacency, the rigors of modern-day life. Nothing can really hurt you. And it's very interesting, we're experiencing that now during the pandemic, and we're, a lot of us are kind of shaken out of this complacency that nothing can really hurt us, but then we're brought to reality with nature, either by the birds or with Roger Thornhill's case. He's shaken out of his complacency because he becomes targeted by being the wrong man.
Tony Lee Morrell is with us. He's author and filmmaker, author of books about Hitchcock. We're going to take a break in our show. I hope you can join with us for part two of our conversation with Tony Lee Morrell. This is Constant Wonder. You're listening to Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. Part two now of our conversation with Tony Lee Morrell. He is author of Hitchcock and the Making of Marnie, The Making of Hitchcock's The Birds, and Alfred Hitchcock's Movie Making Masterclass. Tony, in our first part of our conversation, we got going a little bit on The Birds. And, you know, this masterclass concept, is there something from a masterclass that could apply to The Birds?
Oh, absolutely. And the Birds is one long masterclass. It's studied by film theorists, by musicians, technicians, storyboard artists, because it's superbly constructed and very thoughtfully and carefully constructed by Hitchcock and his A-team. And when I say his A-team, he was surrounded by the best. He had a production designer, Robert Boyle. He had a storyboard artist, Harold Michelson. He had an electronic score, which was supervised in Germany. And he had some great animal trainers like Ray Bowick. So it was very much a masterclass.
I was trying last night as I watched The Birds to figure out which of the birds were mechanical and which ones were real birds. And I couldn't succeed at that. Can you figure it out? Have you seen it enough times to know which are which?
Yes, the mechanical birds were mainly used with the children. So when they're running down the hill and then you have some close-ups of the birds pecking on them, and also during the bird party, the birthday party of the children. So anything involving children was usually used for mechanical birds. But real birds were used in the famous attic sequence with Tippi Hedren, with trained birds, and also with Rod Taylor. He actually, there was a raven which had a kind of liking for Rod Taylor, and it would bite his hand. And so absolutely, real birds were used most of the time.
Yeah. Well, I don't like to be a naysayer. I don't like to be a party pooper. But as I was watching The Birds, for me, the weakest point was the dialogue. Am I so wrong there? There was just dialogue that didn't strike me as terribly credible, and yet that didn't really get in the way of my full experience of the movie, I should say.
Yes, Evan Hunter, who sadly passed away, but I interviewed Evan. He was a great screenwriter. He was really known to be a novelist as Ed McBain. He wrote the Precinct Police Detective series. But Evan would agree with you. It started off as a light comedy, and it evolved into really a kind of horror, early horror. And maybe the juxtaposition didn't really work well, and it was a little contrite, the dialogue. Evan felt that it wasn't totally realistic in that, wealthy playgirls don't schlep up 60 miles up the coast to drop bird cages on unknown bachelors that they find in pet shops. So, but for Hitchcock, it was really the premise, as I said, that was more important to him than the dialogue, the notion, the unpredictability of nature and why birds would attack. And as Hitchcock said, he was very enthralled about this idea of complacency, because it was written in 1962 during the Cuban Missile Crisis. It was during the Cold War. During JFK's, just before JFK would become assassinated in 1963. So there was a lot of tensions in the world, and Hitchcock used the birds as a metaphor for those tensions and how people respond to it. And the people in the birds did respond well, because you've got that famous sequence in the restaurant, when the Thai restaurant, when they're all debating what the birds mean. And it's almost like today, but, you know, I drew parallels with the pandemic before, but we're all sitting around discussing how we can control this pandemic in the same ways the characters did with the birds over 50, almost 60 years now.
I could not help but see some parallels to our psychological perplexity, where with isolation and distancing, that is kind of mirrored in my mind by now we have to stay inside. That's very much – staying inside is very important in the birds.
Yes. And there's a great sequence and metaphor, a reverse, when Hitchcock was very clever with that. You start off with the birds being caged in the pet shop, and then Melanie takes the two lovebirds in her car in the cage. But then Melanie becomes caged herself in that famous telephone booth sequence when she's attacked by flying birds who break the glass. And then the house itself becomes a cage for the whole Brenner family during that incredible sequence at the end when the birds are attacking the house. And Hitchcock used a drum roll to imitate the bird attack so that the actors could respond. He had someone beat a drum so that they would respond to the noise. And, you know, during lockdown or shelter in place, we are the birds now, because we've all been asked to stay inside and stay inside our houses. So it seems like a role reversal of nature. And Hitchcock was so clever like that. He really anticipated those kind of genres, because the birds was ahead of its time in the kind of man versus nature, which the cycle of which really started in the 1970s.
Now, I have to say, when I was watching last night, half of the movie for me took place after the close of the actual film, because there was no clear resolution. The tensions remain in place. And if the historical frame for this was, the early 60s and the tensions of the Cold War and the Cuban Missile Crisis, I just wonder to what extent Hitchcock intended to leave this a story with no resolution, to leave it so open-ended?
That was a deliberate ploy and a point of great contention and discussion, because originally the ending was that the Brenner family in the convertible would reach a Golden Gate Bridge and find it covered with birds, i.e. the birds are taking over city and eventually the planet. But Hitchcock wanted a more European art house ending, and so you have that famous shot of the Brenner car driving away into the distance, and that final shot is a matte painting of many different composites of images of live birds and studio birds and location birds. And he deliberately wanted that, because, as you say, what would happen after? There is no end. There is no credit which says the end, which you traditionally get in a studio movie. But Hitchcock wanted the idea that, as you say, what happens to the Earth is up to you in your imagination after that.
Now, I mentioned earlier in our conversation that as my 12-year-old boy and I were watching it, we had some fun just kind of snickering a little about some of the special effects that in our day and age seem a little bit clunky. And yet the effect, the overall impact of the film was not lost on us at all. In fact, at one point, as Tippi Hedren, I believe, making her way up the stairs, slowly the suspense just builds and builds and builds. And my boy said something about this is it. This is the worst part of the whole movie. And there wasn't any blood at that point. It was just the protracted suspense. And that just seemed unbearable. I don't know how long it lasted. Maybe that's only a 90-second scene, but boy, it seemed like an hour.
Yes, Hitchcock was very good at putting the audience in the character. And you have a special trademark of Hitchcock for that sequence, which is a forward point of view tracking shot. So the camera assumes the point of view, what the character is seeing. Most famously in Psycho, if you watch Psycho and you see the Lila Crane, who's played by Vera Miles, if you see her investigating the Bates Motel house, she similarly gets many tracking forward point of view shots as she's going up the stairs and down to the cellar and discovers Mrs. Bates. And so, yes, we're very privileged to be put in the character's position in those kind of sequences.
How keen are you on looking at the work of Alfred Hitchcock and trying to draw any connections to his own life story?
Well, very much he drew upon his own life experiences. As you know, he was born in England in 1899, and his career and life really spans the history of cinema. He started as an assistant director and a storyboard artist early, and his career spans from the silent pictures to the advent of talkies. He directed Blackmail, famously used sound effects and dialogue. Right up until 1980, he went through the whole studio system, went through people like David Selznick, who produced Gone with the Wind, and he invited Hitchcock to come over to direct Rebecca. And he was extremely well-traveled. He loved Europe. He loved traveling. And he filmed Man Who Knew Too Much, a second version in Morocco. And so he was like a sponge. He absorbed things and sights and sounds and people he met, and he would put all that up in, as his art for these great movies. So absolutely, you know, when you look at his film, you can analyze it and say he would put so much of himself and his art and his life on film. And I wrote a whole book on Marnie, and that's probably one of his most personal films because he very much identified with the Marnie character. He grew up in England in East End. And many people derive that famous shot of Marnie's house with a big ship, the fake ship in the background. And he got that idea from the docks in the East End of London where he grew up, and the big ships would come right up to the wharf and dwarf the houses. So, yes, very much. You can analyze a movie and see the famous Hitchcock imprints on it.
The reason I ask the question is because when we go to an autobiography or biography of any artist like this and we try to see connections, what we're really looking for is some kind of transparency into the personality of the person. And I think of Hitchcock as being rather opaque, as being aloof at the very least, and keeping up a facade, an incredible facade. Am I so wrong there?
Well, people love to discuss Hitchcock because obviously his relationship with the heroine. From my studies, I believe that he absolutely adored women, and many screenwriters, including females like J. Preston Allen, say the same. He had a real empathy for the woman, the suffering heroine, and that's why we spoke about Cary Grant being kind of envious of the portrayal of women, giving more to the women's side than, say, the male side. So I think he was very much emphatic with the woman's position. Some people may say he was opaque. It was very much his British reserve, perhaps, but he had a great Cockney sense of humor. He was very much frightened as a school child. There's that famous quote and story of being put in a prison cell at the age of 5 years old by the local police because his father felt he needed to be taught a lesson. This is what naughty boys would do, you know, get put in prison is what to say to him. And so he had that lifelong fear of the police, and so the wrongfully accused man is always running from the police. And so, I mean, you can analyze all these things. I agree, there is an opaqueness about him. He always said his idea of calm was a clear horizon, and so he very much relished order and control and like things neat and tidy, which is where he would often fall out with actors who didn't kind of conform to his neat and tidiness.
Talk to us a little, if you would, about the battles that he would occasionally have with sort of the, well, the censors or the people in charge of what was proper to put in a movie. He pushed the limits there.
Absolutely. There's a famous shot in Psycho when they throw the the note down the toilet. And he had to battle with the censors to get a flushing toilet in. Remember, this was 1959, 1960, and a flushing toilet had never been seen in a mainstream movie. And so he had to battle that. He had to, later on in the 1970s, when things became more permissible, in Frenzy, for example, he was able to see a strangulation and even a breast. But he wasn't really that kind of director. He was more suggestive. He wanted to show the suggestion of murder or the suggestion of sex. But he early on, there were battles with dialogue. For example, the most famous one in North by Northwest, if you watch Eva Mary Saint on the 20th Century Limited, she says, "I never make love on an empty stomach." The censors asked him to dub that, and so she actually says in the movie, "I never discuss love on an empty stomach." But if you watch her lips, she actually says, "Make love." But that's him as a filmmaker, always trying to push the envelope, push the boundaries.
I'm very interested in the couple of images I'm looking at right now. I'm looking at Alfred Hitchcock with his left arm raised and a raven or a crow, probably a raven, perched on it. And adjacent to that, I think, is a picture of you in that very same pose also with the raven. Was that a live bird you posed with?
Yes, that was for my Making of the Birds book publicity. There's a great bird trainer who I know, because I have to tell you, my background's in wildlife films. So we used Bran the Raven for that, and that was a deliberate homage to Hitchcock.
Yeah, it's a delightful picture. And even the raven is almost in the exact same stance, the legs position. So multiple takes to get that photo, I'm guessing.
Yeah, that was a fun day doing that.
Well, such a delight to get to meet you and to talk with you today. Tony Lee Morrell, thank you for being with us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Author and filmmaker Tony Lee Morrell. He's author of Hitchcock and the Making of Marnie, The Making of Hitchcock's The Birds, and Alfred Hitchcock's Movie-Making Masterclass. Now, it's easy to think that Hitchcock was the master of suspense, but then what would you call the young Orson Welles? A man destined to become a great Hollywood film actor and director, but he got his start scaring the pants off of an entire nation with his 1938 War of the Worlds radio drama. Was that show as scary as legend would have it? Find out when Constant Wonder returns after this short break. Thanks for listening to Constant Wonder. We've been focusing this hour on one of the great filmmakers of Hollywood's golden age, Alfred Hitchcock. And now we turn to a world-famous stunt that the master surely appreciated for its mad genius, and probably Hitchcock wished he'd thunk it up himself. You've heard of Orson Welles' famous or infamous radio show that kind of pretended to be a news account of an alien invasion from outer space. This was broadcast in 1938. You probably remember the story, but none of us remember actually experiencing that, I doubt. A few of us. But the legend of that live broadcast is that it sent thousands of people into a panic. But did it really? To learn more, I spoke with Michael Sokolow, a professor of communications at the University of Maine. Here's a slice of the original radio drama to get us started. It's a radio news broadcast, supposedly from the site where an alien spaceship has landed. The reporter on the scene describes what happens next.
Nothing's happening. Ladies and gentlemen, this is terrific. This end of the thing is beginning to flake off. The top is beginning to rotate like a screw, and the thing must be hollow.
He's moving! Look, keep back there! Keep back there! Keep those men back! Keep back there! Keep those idiots back! Come on, get back.
Well, ladies,
he's off! The top flew!
Look out there! Stand back!
Well, ladies and gentlemen, this is the most terrifying thing I've ever witnessed. Wait a minute. Someone's crawling out of the hollow top.
Someone or something I can see peering out of that black hole, two luminous discs. Or the eyes, it might be a face, might be almost there. But heavens, something wriggling out of the shadow like a gray snake. Now it's another one and another one and another one. They look like tentacles to me. Oh, yeah, I can see the thing's body. Now it's large. It's large as a bear. It glistens like wet leather, but that face,
Ladies and gentlemen, it's indescribable. I can hardly force myself to keep looking at it. It's so awful. The eyes are black and they gleam like a serpent. The mouth is a kind of V-shape with saliva dripping from its rimless lips. It seems to, I don't know, quiver and pulsate. And the monster or whatever it is can hardly move. It seems weighed down by...
Well, there's a sample for you of that. We remember that so well. Not that we were there when it happened, but if it didn't look like it had tentacles, it sure did sound like it. That's the power of radio. Well, at the end of the broadcast of War of the Worlds, Orson Welles tagged that whole experience with this disclaimer.
This is Orson Welles, ladies and gentlemen, out of character to assure you that the War of the Worlds has no further significance than as the holiday offering it was intended to be. The Mercury Theater's own radio version of dressing up in a sheet and jumping out of a bush and saying boo. Starting now, we couldn't soap all your windows and steal all your garden gates by tomorrow night, so we did the best next thing. We annihilated the world before your very ears and utterly destroyed the CBS. You will be relieved, I hope, to learn that we didn't mean it and that both institutions are still open for business.
That was the disclaimer as it was heard, but that was heard actually. So the story goes, before thousands upon thousands had run out screaming into the streets, believing the end was at hand, some committing suicide, others falling to the ground with strokes or heart attacks. How did this stunt actually play out, though, and how many people died at the hand of Orson Welles with his weaponized medium of radio? To help us learn about what really went down, we have with us Michael Sokolow, an associate professor of communications at the University of Maine. He is qualified to paint a far more accurate picture, not only of what happened, but what didn't happen, and also... all of the factors, the situation, the evolution of modern media with competition between, say, old-fashioned newspapers and newer broadcast technologies, that's part of the story, too. Michael Sokolow, welcome to Constant Wonder.
Good afternoon.
Now, this, what we've heard, so familiar. Did you grow up knowing this story about the suicides, the mass hysteria, all of that?
Well, I think we all did, you know, because it was a part of sort of eighth grade and even high school history textbooks. When you study American history, it's a major moment right before World War II.
Yeah, and I bought it hook, line, and sinker, and I think everybody around me did, and I think there are people still doing that today.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a fantastic tale. Let's be honest about that. If you get away from its historical accuracy or anything, it's a pretty incredible moment.
Well, it is. But what makes it so incredible, not just Martians and the people thinking that there's veracity to this, it's an incredible moment because the technology is still relatively new or because people are scared of Nazis and that. What's going on?
Oh, I think it's an incredible moment because it reveals something to me, and this is where sort of my interest in it came from as a media historian. It reveals something to me about how we as humans like to think about each other. You know, a larger sort of social psychological perspective on it. In other words, I think if you look back on it, we like to think of that audience as naive, as particularly naive or unready for what radio news meant, rather than thinking about them as we are, you know, a little bit more skeptical, a little bit more understanding of how the media works in our life in certain ways. And when you really begin to dig into it, you realize that the panic was way, way overplayed. And that's where my interest came in.
Now, when you say the panic was way overplayed, do you mean in the news reports about the broadcast and its impact on people?
Well, let's be clear. There's different ways to look at the panic historically. Now, we're not talking about in 1938, contemporarily, but people who wanted to figure out what happened looking back on it. And if you look back on it and you trust just the newspapers, you'll believe all these unattributed, unnamed witnesses. There's all these series of articles about these phantom mobs. But one of the things that fascinated me is nobody in these mobs is quoted by name. And then when you start to dig in deeper and you start looking at the data, things like the ratings, the Hooper ratings on that night, it just so happens that there had been an actual telephone survey done during the show, and 98% of the respondents were not listening, or were listening to the number one show in America at the time, which was called the Chase and Sanborn Hour. And of the 2% of respondents who were listening, none were panicked. And then there were a couple other surveys done within the next 24 hours. And generally, it's very difficult to locate somebody who was really panicked in that moment.
How do you find a survey from that long ago? Did you have to ferret that out somehow?
Yeah, that was part of my research. So far, I found four. One has been kept hidden secret by CBS. And actually, that's by far the biggest nationwide one. CBS's head of research was a guy named Frank Stanton. He was a PhD from Ohio State, and he was actually listening that night. And brilliantly, he drove right in. He lived in Manhattan near the near CBS headquarters. He drove over there, and less than 12 hours later, he had a huge national survey firm based out of Atlanta conduct a national survey about what had happened, because he was very worried that the federal government would be upset. And the data from that survey we have summarized in places, but we've never actually gotten the raw data. And it does show that almost nobody was listening. And of the people who were actually listening, almost all of them understood it was a radio show. It wasn't a news broadcast.
Well, can you help me out with this idea that he was worried about the federal government being alarmed about the broadcast?
Well, you can imagine there's a parallel today, right? When we see Mark Zuckerberg up on Capitol Hill talking to senators and congressmen about what Facebook is and isn't and what it's doing or not doing politically. In 1938, radio was the new medium, and nobody had tried, in the United States at least. There had been phony news broadcasts, one in England and one in Australia, that had gotten a lot of press, but nobody had done it nationwide in the United States by 1938. And it's more than just a phony newscast. It's a phony newscast that intentionally seeks to panic people. And as you can imagine, if you happen to be listening and catch it and you worked for that company, you'd get very nervous very quickly. And that's why the headquarters of CBS were completely flooded by the end of the show. They were flooded with New York City policemen. All the employees came in that Sunday night. As well as the actors and all the newspapermen of New York.
So there was, at least in New York City, there at the studio, there was a gathering, not of panicked people, but of angry people because of what had gone on.
Right, and they had heard the rumors, especially through the police department. There's certain things about the panic that we know. The telephone exchanges for Manhattan and New Jersey were overloaded that night. People did pick up the phone and wanted to check on the rumors. But what's interesting is, as many people have pointed out since, that's the rational response, right? The irrational response is running downstairs, screaming that the world's coming to an end. In fact, overwhelmingly, people didn't believe the news broadcast, and the ones who had access to telephones picked up their telephones and called somebody, and they quickly were disabused of the idea that this was a real invasion. And so the irony is that when you actually look at the data, it proves people acted rationally rather than irrationally.
Do you think the police acted rationally? I mean, if you're a police officer, you show up there. What's your job? Are you looking just for a public nuisance and trying to – I mean, it's too late by then.
Exactly. Well, you know, it's interesting because the radio editor of the New York Daily News wrote a memoir, and he included his memory. One of the things he found very strange that night is when he took a taxi cab from his apartment in Uptown New York down to Midtown where CBS was. There was nobody on the street, supposedly in the middle of this crazy panic. And so the police would be flooded with phone calls, but they would have seen that nobody was out there. And that's the interesting question. And I think the Midtown police in Manhattan went into CBS just to tell them to knock it off, basically, that their phones are ringing off the hook. That's my guess. I don't know exactly why the police were there.
Well, let's just talk about the context in which this all happens. It's still kind of the early days of radio. This kind of radio drama is not well – I mean, I guess this is very – enterprising. This is very innovative for Orson Welles to do something like this. What is comparably going on in other shows in that era? Which big broadcasts are famous from that time?
Well, there's other shows and there's other dramas. And, of course, Orson Welles had been on things like The Shadow. Actually, he did play Lamont Cranston. He was the star of a mystery show. So he really knew this medium like you couldn't believe. He knew the best ways to do it. But what was brilliant was the writing of it. The performing of it was good, but the writing of it was based on what had happened in the United States 1 month before, which is the Munich crisis of 1938. A month before the War of the Worlds, everybody thought World War II was about to start because Hitler wanted to take over Czechoslovakia. And there had been a series of meetings, and literally the American radio networks were every minute were doing these updates from Europe with the war about to break out. And at the last minute, they got the Munich settlement. So these kind of news breaks that would break in and tell you something scary about war had primed the audience for a script like this. And that's really where the innovation comes in. The idea of making a script based on a new media form of news that everybody had just been primed with 1 month before was brilliant. And that's where I think everybody was kind of taken aback.
Did this lead to any kind of regulation that would preclude this kind of faked news, breaking news update?
Well, it's interesting. A senator from Iowa immediately wanted very strong regulation. In terms of actual regulatory and legislative moves, one of the more fascinating things is not only was nothing passed, but in license renewal hearings for American radio stations, the FCC passed a rule saying you could not compete for a license and hold it against a station that they had aired this show. In other words, if you and I both wanted to apply for a license, say for Salt Lake City for a local station, and you had aired War of the Worlds, I would tell the federal government, I promise not to do phony news shows. And they would look better on me. But the FCC had been worried about that. So actually, it's the opposite. They had protected it. Now, unofficially, the networks went to the government and said, we won't do this again with news.
Well, that's a great concession to make. I can only imagine that being, I guess, well, we're going to be good citizens because we might be on the threshold of world war.
Well, but we're seeing that right now, too, right? Because we saw what Facebook and Twitter and all the social media platforms did in the 26th election. And so what do? They're going to Congress, and they're announcing, oh, we're going to change how we do political ads. Oh, we're going to change the reach of what we consider suspect bots and everything. So we're seeing Facebook, Twitter, we're seeing the social media of today being very compliant with the government because they're afraid of real regulation. They're afraid of real rules that would change their business model. So they're going to do a whole bunch of things voluntarily. So we're kind of living in a parallel in that way. But I will say this. One thing that's not really known as much is that the government had been worried about radio going back at least 5 years because President Roosevelt's fireside chats were so powerful that the White House actually asked the March of Time and other dramatized news shows not to pretend to be the president. So there had been a couple earlier discussions about how news should play out on the radio.
Now, as long as we're talking about parallels between this day of social media and then we're going way back to the early days of radio, today some of the criticism in terms of our behavior, our human behavior vis-a-vis social media, people glued to screens. You know, a husband's trying to talk to a wife and or the other way around, and one of them's not listening to the other, and there's marital discord. Was radio ever – is there anything going on like that where the new technology is so compelling that it's disrupting social behavioral norms?
Absolutely. I published an article in the Historical Journal of Film, Radio, and Television about specifically what you just described, and it opens up with a story of a divorce from Minneapolis, Minnesota, that made the front page of the New York Times because a woman wanted to divorce her husband over radio mania. He was so addicted to his radio that he wasn't working and he was ignoring his kids and wife. And this appeared on page A1 of the New York Times in 1923. So when we hear things about internet addiction or media compulsion and all these kind of things, it happens every time. It's cyclical. It happened with television. Happened with radio. It's now happening. It happened with the web, which was only 20 years ago, and it's now happening with social media.
Now, part of the way you talk about this, I know, as you've written about it, it has to do with the way print media responded to all of this? It looked like they were opportunistic and wanted to somehow figure out a way to cash in somehow on this.
Absolutely. And what they really wanted was for people to purchase newspapers and to make radio news less credible. In other words, if you can't trust radio news, you're going to have to rely on your evening and morning newspapers. And there's some sort of parallel with that happening right now, though newspapers are having a really difficult problem. But the whole concept of fact-checking, right, and the whole concept of media literacy and all the stuff that the old media, which includes broadcasting now, is trying to do against Facebook and Google and social media is that it's not credible, right? Don't believe what you see in your Facebook feed. Buy the newspaper or trust the newspaper's website.
Is there anything in this parallel universe way back with radio that is instructive for us today as we're trying to navigate some of these same concerns about the ethics of conveying information, whether it's fact or fiction, and how you frame it, how you present it to the public as though it were true, or trying to actually promulgate misinformation? Is there something we can learn from the way Orson Welles was handled with War of the Worlds?
Absolutely. And I think what we can learn is that Orson Welles was brilliant, okay? His idea, the script writing, the performance, regardless of whether the panic happened or not, we have to realize that there are people out there who understand how to use the media in ways that we, as the audience, or even politicians or regulators, aren't sophisticated enough to understand, right? And that's what Welles did. It doesn't matter whether the panic happened or not. What happened was he created this media universe that was so believable and brilliant and sophisticated that it created this myth in that way or whatever. And to me, the parallel kind of question or the interesting question is, assuming that the social media is being manipulated in ways, and that's not my assumption or conclusion. That's the conclusion of the Directorate of National Intelligence of the United States, right? And they've come out with a report about the 2016 election where they have stated Russian trolls and bots were involved in influencing the election. And the question is, those people out there who are seeking to influence us might be so much more sophisticated than we assume, the way Orson Welles was, that we really have to think about how this works. Now, a big difference is Welles held a press conference the next morning, and he was incredibly contrite, and he said he would never do this again, and he was shocked. Whereas the people who are trying to manipulate us today, I think, are less contrite.
And was that an act, too, or do you think he was really contrite?
Well, it's funny you say that. You know, the producer of the show, John Houseman, wrote a piece in Harper's a few years later, and he called the press conference. It's interesting, in light of Citizen Kane and in light of War of the Worlds, he said the press conference the morning after War of the Worlds was the greatest performance of Orson Welles' career.
It was a performance, at least according to him.
According to him, apparently, you know, this is for people who study Welles. This is obviously a very important question. You know, did he wink at Houseman just before he went out there? Because here's the interesting thing: the press conference is on YouTube, and here we are, you know, 80 years later, 90 years later, and we can call it up on YouTube and we can see ourselves whether we believe Welles is contrite or not. And if he's not contrite, I will say it is an incredible performance. He does look chastened and sorry.
Knowing everything you know about Orson Welles and War of the Worlds and the supposed panic that really didn't happen at the levels people say it did, how do you feel about an artist pulling a stunt like this? Do you have any personal take on it where you just say, I wish he'd never done that, or has it helped launch your own career?
It's been very helpful for my career, but it raises so many, you know, fascinating questions about what we believe and how we believe it, especially when it comes to media. And I see it constantly recurring. So I'll give you an example. I don't know if you saw this big controversy about a public health campaign in South Dakota called Meth, We're On It.
Yes, I've caught wind of that.
Okay. Now, it's gone incredibly viral, and everybody's talking about it as a disaster, because supposedly it was a giant mistake, right? Who on earth would put out posters and announcements saying Meth, We're On It when, you know, talking about drugs? Well, it turns out that the Minneapolis ad firm had literally designed it for virality through ridicule, They wanted people to see it, laugh at it, and pass it on Facebook and Twitter, because then journalists would pick it up and they would interview people. And so the woman who approved the campaign has now been on NPR. She's quoted in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the governor of South Dakota. And you know what? They spend about a teeny little bit on the ad, and then they talk about the problem of meth use in South Dakota. And they talk about the resources, and they talk about the website that they did. And it turns out it's one of the most brilliant public health campaigns ever, because for the cost of the paid media, they've taken this virality of the credibility of journalism, and they've leveraged it. And so that's the kind of thing. I see that kind of thing happening, and it just is mind-boggling to me that people like Wells or this ad agency in Minneapolis are so savvy.
It really is sophisticated in a big way, isn't it? Oh, my. When I first saw that, I thought to myself, what's going on here? And so in a way, it sucked me in too. And what about you? Did you get sucked in by it, or did you hear the analysis first?
It's interesting. I did not – I'm at a point now, and it's interesting because I'm a professor who teaches this, right? At the graduate level, I actually teach propaganda campaigns and strategies. And I was a teeny bit skeptical. I didn't quite understand it. And then when I found out – because, by the way, the people who approved the campaign and were involved in it are admitting the whole thing now because they look like geniuses. And then I thought, oh, wow, this is next level. This is the world we're heading into, where sort of misinformation is being strategically placed in front of us so that our friends, our credibility is being exploited.
And everything you've said just convinces me that the war of the worlds is not a passé topic at all. It's very important to us. Michael Sokolow, a pleasure to visit with you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Michael Sokolow is a professor of communications at the University of Maine. The Scarecrow in The Wizard of Oz had to wonder what it would be like, what life would be like, if he had a brain. I'll speak for myself. Have you ever wondered why any of us has a brain? Tomorrow on the show, we're going to talk with neuroscientist Lisa Feldman Barrett about that swirly gray blob between our ears. We're going to learn about where brains come from, how they're structured, and why all of this matters. Especially interesting, how the brain works in tandem with other brains to create everything that we humans experience. Join us tomorrow for more Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. Our show is a production of BYU Radio.